Six Democrats are hoping to win the March 20th primary for the governor's race. And on Thursday, they gathered at a forum hosted by WBEZ, Politico, and the University of Chicago. Here's David Axelrod introducing the candidates.
One of these men could be the next governor of Illinois. And yes, they all are men. And they will have to deal with many challenges facing this state.
We'll talk about that, and there are plenty of stories in Illinois state politics every day. But journalist Ellen Mayer says they can be really hard to follow if you're not already a political junkie.
It's not actually that helpful for people who haven't been following that story all along, or who aren't kind of close to or working within politics.
Also, last year, Airbnb says it provided more than $9 million in tax revenue to the state of Illinois. And some Illinois towns are hoping to gather tax money from Airbnbs, just like they do with hotels. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 2018 election primary is just 15 days away. And if you've been paying attention, you know there's no shortage of candidates or money pouring into this campaign. A story just out this morning from the Chicago Sun-Times shows that nearly a quarter of the money contributing to political campaigns in the state came from just four men. How much money are we talking about? More than $175 million coming in from four men. Two of them are running for governor. Our current governor, Bruce Rauner, and J.B. Pritzker, one of his Democratic challengers. All of this as the governor's race reaches the home stretch. Last Thursday, the six men hoping to be the Democratic nominee for governor gathered for a public forum hosted by WBEZ, Politico, and the University of Chicago. The primary is just 2 weeks away. Early voting has already started in many areas. Joining us now to talk about all of this is Amanda Vinicky. She's a correspondent for WTTW Chicago Tonight. Joseph Bustos is also with us. He's a reporter for the Belleville News Democrat. Amanda, Joe, both of you, welcome back to the 21st.
But of course, thank you.
Amanda, let's start with you. We mentioned the piece from the Chicago Sun-Times, which found that nearly a quarter of the money contributing to political campaigns in the state came from four men. I mentioned two of them are running for governor. Can you tell us about who the other two are?
You know, let me just say, first of all, that that was not at all a surprise for me anyway. That has been the case other than J.B. Pritzker's obvious new entry as relatively in the game as a candidate. The other two have long been funders, and one of them is Dick Uline. He is an owner of Uline Packaging Company. So pretty much anybody and everybody with an office, you probably have some products that come to you from the Uline family. And while he is a primary donor here and is listed in that top four, that surely masks his overall influence on politics, because there's a lot of this so-called dark money that is given to what are loosely described as not-for-profit organizations, but they're not doing the sort of charitable work that you may assume. These are organizations such as the Illinois Opportunity Project, the Illinois Policy Institute, that clearly have a great influence, for example, on Rauner's challenger, Jeannie Ives, as well as elsewhere in state politics in that Janus case that was before the U.S. Supreme Court just last week. Dick Uline has a ton of money everywhere. This is just the portion of it that needs to be reported. He was a backer of Rauner, but now, as I noted, is instead backing Jeannie Ives. He is that ultra-conservative that is not pleased with Rauner's tenure. The other, however, is Ken Griffin, the richest man in Illinois and has been for quite a few years, a private equity investor who has continued to give some of his extraordinary wealth to Bruce Rauner and propping up his reelection bid.
That's Amanda Vinicky. She's a correspondent with WTTW Chicago Tonight. Joseph Bustos is with us as well. Joe, when we talk about money, there's an enormous amount of money across all levels of this election cycle, isn't there?
Yeah, I think Uline has also given a lot of money to the Liberty Principles PAC, which has then spent that money in state legislative house races. They've blown the caps off of, I believe, 10 races right now for people running for state rep, and two of those races, at least two, I think even more, are against Republicans who voted for the income tax increase, and they've been buying ads for primary challengers, and one of them, like, is down here in southern Illinois. the 108th. Charlie Meyer is the incumbent. He's been there for, I think, three terms now. And he's being challenged by a gentleman by the name of Don Moore, who's on the Madison County Board. And Don Moore was angry about Charlie Meyer's vote on the income tax increase. And Liberty Principles has bought more than $100,000 worth of advertising and mailings. And we see a lot of Don Moore TV ads down here. And Don Moore only had like about $2,000 or $4,000 in in-kind contributions, and it's amazing he's able to get all these television ads on the air, and a lot of that goes back to people who were upset over the tax increase.
Hmm. And Joe, you also reported about how this issue of money and campaigns is playing out in Southern Illinois, in Illinois' 12th congressional district. For people who are not aware, the district includes parts of Southern Illinois and, of course, the Metro East area just across the border from St. Louis. We have some audio. You actually spoke with Congressman Mike Bost. He's the Republican incumbent in that race, and he defended taking PAC money. Here's what he had to say.
The race in this district is probably going to cost $2.5 to $3 million. Now, whether it's a newspaper, whether it's television, all of those things cost to get your message out, whether it's mailings, and you have to generate that money. If there was a different process out there, then, and people have been trying to work on that process for a long time. And many of the reporting side of our news media ask the question like you do, and I'm glad, because I'm glad to answer it. But your pay side sure doesn't give us free advertisement. And so that's why it's so expensive, and that's why you have to raise the money.
That's Congressman Mike Bost, Republican incumbent in the 12th congressional district. Joe, that's a pretty frank assessment of what it takes to win a race. Is Congressman Bost in a strong position, you think, to win this primary and then reelection in the fall? And I wonder how much his, yeah.
I think he does have a primary challenger, Preston Nelson, who describes himself as a libertarian. Most people are projecting that Congressman Mike Bost and the St. Clair County State's Attorney Brendan Kelly will be winning their respective primaries. Kelly's a Democrat who's been getting a lot of attention from the DCCC. So those two are expected to become win their primaries and head into the November election. It is considered a toss-up election, and there's only a few of those districts within the entire country where you're going to see a lot of attention, because it could decide the fate, the balance of power in the House of Representatives. So it's definitely going to be an expensive race. We're probably going to see a lot of TV ads featuring those two gentlemen. They are already thinking about the general election themselves, and it's going to cost money to, not just for TV advertising, but it's also cost money for staff, and it costs money to put fuel in the car to all that retail politics that's so involved, so important when trying to get people to vote for you.
And Amanda, how much is this factoring into the governor's race as well? As we're thinking, getting back to the governor's race, attorneys general, there's a lot of different money going on here.
Yeah. So in terms of the attorney general's race, the contributions from, for example, cigarette companies, as well as utilities, areas from which you haven't seen the current Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, who, of course, is not running for reelection, hence you have such a contested, particularly on the Democratic side, although the latest polls show it's a really tight race, and the narrower, just two people running in that GOP race, including, of course, Erica Harold from the Champaign area, then Gary Grasso from the suburbs. So that's a pretty even split, actually, in terms of the latest polling, but a lot of money being spent there. The bulk of the money is, however, in this governor's race. And I want to get back to something that Joe mentioned, and that is the contributions from Liberty Principles PAC and Dick Uihlein's funding, which, again, is seeped really everywhere in Illinois and even to an extent national politics. He was the primary funder for a PAC supporting Roy Moore's now failed bid for the U.S. Senate down in Alabama. But that money that's going into House Republican races is really fascinating, because it is kind of the Republican Party almost eating itself. We will see what comes from it, but you typically would see those sort of things if there's an open seat, an open contest, or even, of course, wait until the general election, because some of these areas are where there are targets. It's you mentioned the Boss race, the presumably Boss v. Kelly race downstate, but there are a handful of really competitive congressional races as well, looking to the general election. What we haven't seen in Illinois thus far is what we are seeing this election, and that is the challengers from the right versus, quote, establishment Republicans. And I think that is going to be a huge story to follow after we all find out who's the winner of the Democratic primary for governor and who will presumably, according to polls anyway, be the one that is up against Bruce Rauner. It will be, what does it mean for the character and change of the Illinois House? Because many of these are decided in the primary and not in the general.
Not, and as you say that, Amanda, and you mentioned the congressional races and how competitive they are, certainly the 13th district is another race where we're seeing five challengers against Rodney Davis. I should note to our audience no one's facing Rodney Davis, the incumbent, in the Republican primary, but he has five challengers on the Democratic side. We have recorded interviews with all of those candidates. We're going to start airing those tomorrow. I should also add, while we're talking about money, we've got all of this. We've got a new elections page up for the 21st. If you just go to 21stshow.org/elections, you can see all of the interviews we've recorded with all the candidates for attorney general and a tracker, Amanda, of all of this money. And Amanda, I think it's a kind of an interesting note when we look at the money in the gubernatorial race, how much, for example, J.B. Pritzker is self-funding his campaign. Does he have the biggest amount of self-funding that's going on?
I think technically Rauner is still tops, but that would include money that he put in, frankly, by now, years ago.
During the last run, maybe, right, Amanda?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, and even after, but before this cycle really started, and that allowed him to have a whole lot of money in the bank that presumably was a sort of stick in trying to keep Republicans with him on many of the controversial votes we saw. Obviously didn't particularly come to fruition, though we saw the GOP hold together for a while during that budget impasse there. But what's interesting about J.B. Pritzker is that he is committed to entirely self-funding. So that $63 million, 100% of it comes from him. He has said something similar to what Rauner is is standing up for, giving so much of his own personal finances, reaching into his own wallet to fund his campaign, is that that doesn't allow him to be, quote, bought. Nonetheless, that can, of course, raise issues for many a voter who says, no, wait a second, we want you to be beholden to interests besides your own. Some of these, you can consider lobbyists, you consider PACs as, dirty and bad things, or you can say, okay, that's making sure that you are going to be considering what an entity, a group that I believe in, espouse the beliefs of, is supporting. So it's fascinating there. I think the difference, again, between Pritzker and Rauner is that this is just a primary. So while you look back at what happened some 4 years ago, there was a heck of a lot of money, yes, and Rauner blew records, but that was over the entirety of election. We're already seeing that. I believe Donald Trump spent $66 million, period, for the entirety of the president's race, and Pritzker's already at $63 million. No signs of slowing down. And let's be clear here. Right now, even in this conversation, we've mentioned the names Pritzker and Rauner. How many times? At least a dozen. And none of the opponents in that very crowded Democratic.
So go ahead, Amanda. I'll let you. Would you like to mention all of their names?
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, because, obviously Pritzker is flooding the airwaves, particularly downstate. So therefore, you don't have State Senator Daniel Biss and Chris Kennedy getting the name recognition either on the airwaves or otherwise, because money is validly such a story. Those two, I believe, Kennedy has about $6 million and Biss about $5 million in the bank. Kennedy, obviously, of the Kennedys, and we've seen him, it seems, doing a little bit better in polls, and he's counting on that Kennedy name, but hasn't seen really fundraising success, particularly as some of those contributions have come from his own Kennedy fortune, which we believe, it's hard to tell because we haven't seen full releases of tax records, for example, particularly from Kennedy and Pritzker as much as this, but it's believed that that pales in comparison to the personal money that Pritzker has clearly to put
Yeah, Amanda,
race.
Let's, I wonder,
this,
as you,
I'm the middle class guy.
As you right, and Amanda, as you're talking about that, Joe, I wonder what it looks like in the Metro East area. What are you seeing? Are you seeing ads for Daniel Biss? Are you seeing, are you hearing about Chris Kennedy? I should mention there is also Bob Diber, T.O. Hardiman, and Robert Marshall who are in the race. I don't know if you're seeing any of those names at all. What are you all hearing in your part of the state?
I think Bob Diber is always saying I'm the downstate candidate, but that's a message that's even hard for him to get out here. He only, looking at the latest Paul Simon public policy poll, Bob Diber is only polling at 1%, and he's polling at 5% downstate. You see lots of signs for J.B. Pritzker down here. You don't see any Daniel Biss ads on television downstate, but you may see them online, which is where Daniel Biss probably gets the bigger bang for his buck. I'm not sure when was the last time I saw Chris Kennedy down here. Looking at his schedule, he does a lot of stuff in the Chicago area, which makes sense because that's where most of the voters are. But I know he's trying to get down into the Peoria. Daniel Biss has been down here trying to drum up support. He did a college tour, which included
he's in Champaign
stops,
this evening, I believe. Right, also,
yeah.
Joe. I know because that was part of the campaign to have a televised debate downstate in Springfield, the debate that WCIA was supposed to have that did not happen. So I understand Daniel Biss is having a town hall saying he wants to be in the quote-unquote downstate area as well. Chris Kennedy is also in the Champaign-Urbana area today. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it at that. I want to thank Amanda Vinicky. She's a correspondent with WTTW and Chicago Tonight. Political reporter Joe Bustos from the Belleville News Democrat. We will tweet out Joe's story, by the way, about the 12th Congressional District and that race. As I mentioned, we've got a new elections page up. So if you just head to 21stShow.com/elections, you can see all of our election content. If you're just now starting to pay attention, you can listen to our candidate interviews. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Airbnb has been an extra source of income for many homeowners around the state, but now it's generating tax revenue for the state of Illinois as well. Last month, it announced that it collected $9.3 million in taxes on behalf of hosts. Airbnb first made an agreement with the state to collect and remit quote-unquote hotel taxes and has since made subsequent agreements with Cook County, Chicago, and suburbs such as Evanston, Oak Park, and Schaumburg. With me on the line from Chicago is Ben Bright. He's the Midwest spokesperson for Airbnb. I'm also joined on the line by Lisa Peterson, the director of finance for the Village of Schaumburg. That's in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. And Jen Aholtz, an Airbnb owner in Springfield. Ben, Lisa, Jen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, good morning.
Ben, let's start with you. As many of us are in the process of paying our own taxes this month, I can't say this is necessarily an easy process. Can you break down for us, how does this work? Are there three separate taxes at play here in some cases?
Yeah, it just depends on where you are. So, for example, if you're a host in the Village of Schaumburg, there are three separate taxes that previously you were responsible for. With the village, with the county, and with the state. So obviously it'd be the same if you're in the city of Chicago as well, and it just varies based on where you are in the state. These are very complicated tax structures that were designed with hotels in mind. So for a hotel in Schaumburg, right, you've got accountants. You can figure that out, the different remittance strategies and deadlines. If you're just a regular person, and that's really what Airbnb has done, has made it possible for regular middle-class people, not professionals, to be able to take full economic advantage of their homes, participate in the sharing economy. They are not tax experts. They're not CPAs. Tax remittances are very challenging if you even know the taxes exist in the first place. So that's why we started pursuing these types of tax agreements that authorize Airbnb to collect and remit on behalf of the host. So they don't have to worry about it. All this new revenue goes to the local government, whether it's the village of Schaumburg or the state of Illinois, and everyone's happy.
Can I ask Lisa Peterson if I can bring you in here, Director of Finance for the Village of Schaumburg? Lisa, I don't know how many people are using Airbnb to rent out their homes in Schaumburg. When you all decided we want them on par with hotels and paying the same level of taxes, Lisa, can you tell us the background of that?
Sure. There actually are not a lot of Airbnb properties in Schaumburg, but there was one fairly public property, and it's a treehouse, actually, that was being rented out. And we wanted to ensure that our local taxes were being all treated fairly and consistently. So we started to pursue communication with Airbnb to make sure that any host in Schaumburg was also remitting the local hotel motel tax. And actually, once we got in touch with Airbnb, it has all gone very smoothly from there. And we've been very, very happy with the results that we've seen.
And so, Ben, I wonder if you can explain to us how this works. Are the hosts supposed to pay the taxes? Are they, or do the hosts collect the taxes? Is this something that when someone signs up for an Airbnb, the taxes go directly, if you have an agreement, to that city? Or is Airbnb doing this? How is this working?
So it depends on whether we have a tax agreement in place or not. If we don't, then we inform the hosts, no matter where they are, that you need to know what your local tax structures are, what the tax rates are, who you're supposed to remit to. And again, that's where it becomes very complicated, right? Because you could be talking about three different entities that are collecting taxes and who collect those taxes at three different times of the month. And it is very challenging, right? So when we have these tax agreements in place, it allows Airbnb to automatically collect the tax on the front end directly from the guests. And then remit it directly to the local government. So the money never passes through the host because, part of the beauty of Airbnb is that we handle all the finances. So it's seamless, it's integrated, it's fairly easy. So we now have about 360 of these types of tax agreements with state and local governments just in the United States alone. So, once we have the tax agreements in place, it does create a much easier environment, both for the municipality or the county, as well as the host. So for an Airbnb host in the village of Schaumburg, they don't have to worry about any local taxes whatsoever. Airbnb handles everything. For folks outside of Schaumburg, in mostly the other, villages and municipalities in Cook County, those hosts don't have to worry about the Cook County tax because we have a tax agreement with the county. But there may also be a local municipal tax that they are responsible for. So they need to know that the tax exists. They need to know how to collect it, when to remit, and how to go about that.
That's Ben Bright. He's a Airbnb spokesman for the Midwest. Lisa Peterson is with us as well. She's Director of Finance at Schaumburg, telling us how this works for the city of Schaumburg. I want to go to Jen Aholt. Jen, first, before we get to how complicated this may be for you, how long have you been an Airbnb host? Why did you decide to do it?
I'm going on 4 years, and I started it when I had used Airbnb myself, and I realized how easy it seemed and how much my house would benefit from it. I have a very old home, very large, and so I'm able to make a lot of updates with the income. Additionally, I traveled the same way when I lived overseas 20 years ago, and it was a great way to have the world come to me rather than me travel the world while I have two boys. So there was a lot of benefits and for various reasons.
And because you're outside of Cook County, you're in Springfield. Before you started, how did you familiarize yourself with the tax rules, or how did you figure that out?
Everything's listed on Airbnb. If you want more information, they generally have a link that will take you to explain something, and they do a great job of doing it regionally. So it's not just a generic explanation, but it's centric to where you are.
And so what is the tax situation for Springfield? Is this, I don't know if Sangamon County or if Springfield, is there a county or a municipality collection?
It just passed within, I don't even think it's been a month, but it's a 12.5% tax, a hotel motel tax, just passed through city council. So it's not, as far as I'm concerned, being collected just yet. I think they're putting that in place.
And Lisa, for you all, as you said you wanted to make sure you had sort of a fair playing field from a tax standpoint between hotels and Airbnb. Springfield sounds like they've just decided to do that. Lisa, are you getting very much revenue right now from Airbnb? How much are you all getting in terms of tax revenue?
On average, it's about $500 a month.
So I would imagine that's pretty small compared to what you're getting from hotels in Schaumburg.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So why was it important? Was it important for you all, you said, from a fairness standpoint to do this? Or is it just more a matter of thinking we don't know how big Airbnb will be? We're missing out on a source of revenue.
It really was making sure that the tax was being applied consistently and fairly for any entity renting rooms, or, you know, the letting of rooms is how our ordinance is written. I mean, certainly Airbnb has been hugely successful. Like I said, we don't have a lot of properties in Schaumburg that are currently listed on the Airbnb website, but it's very successful. It's very popular. And, you know, we didn't want to miss out on that either. But really the crux of it was to make sure that our tax was applied consistently, and we didn't upset hotel owners saying, hey, you know, why they're my competition, why don't they have to pay the tax?
Ben, from Airbnb's perspective, what made you all decide to get involved and collect taxes on behalf of the hosts? Is it really so you're making sure that the municipalities you're operating in, you're kind of just keeping everybody happy?
That's part of it. Yeah, I mean, our hosts want to pay their fair share, and we want to help, because I just can't emphasize this enough. These taxes are complicated. They're very complex. They're difficult to figure out. So we want to make it as easy as possible for our hosts to be able to pay their fair share, contribute local revenue. You know, we want local governments to be happy. Absolutely. You know, when local governments are able to bring in what effectively amounts to new revenue without having to raise taxes, you know, how often does an opportunity like that come around? And Springfield is actually a great example. Evanston just did this a few months ago. Similarly, their local law actually did not allow for short-term rentals to be taxed like hotels are. You know, these are ordinances that were drafted and passed into law, obviously well before, you know, they anticipated the sharing economy, you know, coming about and making it easy for regular people to participate. So the laws didn't really reflect reality anymore. So Evanston went about and they changed that law with our support. We 100% supported them with that and said, okay, now the same taxes apply to short-term rentals as they do to hotels, and then we were able to immediately enter into a tax agreement with them in order to make sure that they were getting that new revenue. It sounds like Springfield is following that same model and is close to getting to the finish line, and we would love to be able to enter into a tax agreement with Springfield as well.
Jen, as someone who's an Airbnb owner in Springfield, is this something that you were had an opinion on, being for or against having taxes collected?
I didn't speak out for or against, but I assumed it was a matter of time.
Right. Do you worry as a host that higher taxes might drive people away from Airbnb?
It's not much left besides hotel. Airbnb has a choice to stay in Springfield, so that concern doesn't exist there, but it's just one more thing for them to pay. But it's a reasonable tax, so, or it's a reasonable ask for them to pay anyhow. Our tax is a little high in Springfield.
The hotel tax.
Mm-hmm.
And Jen, do you feel like this, the tax situation as a host, is it complicated? Do you have someone else who prepares your taxes to handle all of your Airbnb revenue? How does that work?
Up to this point, it was very easy. The 1099 is downloaded from the Airbnb site. Everything is completed for me. I hope that Springfield partners with Airbnb to make it just as easy. Otherwise, there would be an issue there because it's really not equal. There's, you know, hotels or corporations with staff and lawyers to work through the
tax
burden.
And lots of accountants, right?
I'm sorry?
And lots of accountants also, I imagine.
Oh, right. And if it, you know, if there's not that agreement, then there will be a challenge. And then I would have to, you know, look at how to go about, you know, collecting that and remitting that to the city and then doing the paperwork each year after.
And Jen, we know there's quite a few hotels in Springfield. How many Airbnbs are there? Do you find that there's a lot of competition for people?
I looked the other day, and it looked like there was about 30 in the Springfield area. I don't know, you know, what that means as far as per capita, if that's a lot or not, comparatively speaking to other communities. But in the past 4 years, it's increased. There may have been about 10 when I first started.
Ben, I don't know if you have numbers for Airbnb owners in the Champaign-Urbana area, but it certainly seems like there's a lot more than 30 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Do you have a tax revenue agreement in place with Champaign County or with the cities of Champaign or Urbana?
We do not. I believe we've been in contact with their local destination marketing organizations. If you were to combine Champaign and Urbana, they would amount to the number two Airbnb market in the state, ahead of Evanston, actually. So very important market to us. And really any city that has a large university, I'd say including Springfield, as an important part of their local identity, those are cities where Airbnb and our host communities play a huge role, right? Because there's going to be a few times a year, whether it's football games or college commencement, right, where you're going to have huge, huge surges in travelers and people who need places to stay, right? You're not going to not come to your kids' college graduation just because hotels are sold out, right? But the hotels simply cannot handle that level of demand. You're not going to build a hotel just to accommodate a couple weekends. But local hosts sharing their homes, you know, can help make that inventory and those rooms scalable and make sure that everyone who wants a place to stay can find a place to stay that's revenue that's staying within the community. So so Springfield, Champaign, Urbana, these are very, very important markets to us, and where there's a huge trickle-down effect for the local economy. We do not have tax agreements with those three cities, but we would love to have them soon. You know, we really, you know, we use these agreements, whether it's a huge one with the state of Illinois or with the village of Schaumburg or Oak Park or Rockford, anywhere. You know, we like to use those as opportunities to spread the good word, you know, throughout the state, because, you know, we don't have the bandwidth to reach out to every single city proactively. But hopefully there are a few, you know, comptrollers or tax collectors or revenue directors who are listening to this right now and are realizing, hey, there's an opportunity to take advantage of that new revenue. You know, we want to hear from them. We want to work with them and get as many tax agreements done in the state of Illinois as possible.
Ben, so you said you've collected more than $9 million in taxes to deliver back to the state of Illinois. You said the number two area is Champaign-Urbana. I imagine number one is within city limits of Chicago. Where else is this revenue coming from?
Absolutely. So just this, you know, pure cities, not combining Champaign and Urbana. Evanston is actually number two. So again, that speaks to the impact of a local university where you have massive surges all of a sudden. Other top cities, Oak Park is up there. Champaign-Urbana, I mentioned. Springfield is top 10. Carbondale, another great example. Obviously, you have the university down there, but also Carbondale really took center stage during the solar eclipse last year. All of a sudden, you had tens of thousands of people who wanted to be in Carbondale during a random day in August. Obviously, hotels sold out many, many months in advance, but local homeowners in the city of Carbondale were able to take advantage and allow many, many more people to stay within the city limits. And while they were there, you know, hopefully experience a city that otherwise they might not have thought to visit. And
right, so lots
again.
Of so, revenue
yeah.
coming from all
so
over
Rockford's
the state.
Up there, Naperville. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm afraid we're out of time, but you mentioned Naperville as well. I want to thank Ben Bright. He's Airbnb's Midwest spokesman. Lisa Peterson for giving us a sense of how this works in the village of Schaumburg, where she is the director of finance, and Airbnb owner in Springfield, Jen Ahold. All three of you, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting The Aesthetics of Collective Experience, March 9th at 4 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. Artist Amanda Browder will discuss her public art project, Chromatopia, and giving voice to a community with collaborative art practices. cas.illinois.edu.
To the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this hour, we brought you some of the biggest stories in state politics from the past week. Like we do every Monday, there's always plenty to talk about, especially as we're getting so close to the March 20th primary date. What goes on in Springfield affects all of us throughout the state, but if you're not already a political junkie, it can be hard to keep up with all of this. And if you're hoping to get up to speed in time for the election this November, Ellen Mayer has got you covered. She's a Chicago journalist. She's just started a new podcast called Illinois. That's Illinois, ending with the word noise. And it focuses on your questions about how state government works. She's here with me in Evanston, at our studio at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Ellen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
So you're a journalist, but your background hasn't always been in politics. When did you realize that you really wanted to understand state government and how it works?
So it really all started, I would say, in 2016 during kind of the campaign crazies. And I was starting to feel just extremely overwhelmed by kind of national media coverage of the campaign and a little disillusioned and just feeling pretty powerless in the kind of national political sphere, and just decided that one way that I could go about combating that feeling was by focusing my energies more locally and trying to figure out what was happening in my city in Chicago and what was happening in the state, and kind of started working toward educating myself and my friends a little bit more about what was happening with down ballot elections in 2016. And that's really where it got started.
And I think it's interesting that you say as a journalist, you felt powerless, because I think that's what a lot of people who are not journalists say they felt that way. And did your friends, what kind of conversation did you have? Did you realize that there was just, do you feel like a lot of, and I think we hear this a lot with political reporting, that it wasn't necessarily, did that make you feel even more powerless listening to a lot of the political reporting that's out there?
Yeah, I think it's not always, political reporting is not always oriented explicitly toward being useful for people who aren't experts already, or who aren't, like you said, political junkies. When you think about what's going to be most useful for the average voter, it might not be, well, here's where this person is at the polls, or here's how much money they've made. Not a dig to what you were talking about earlier today, because that's important. But, you know, how to just kind of understand what's going on at a very basic level and figure out who is my rep, how do I, you know, get in touch with them, and, you know, what are they actually doing on my behalf? That stuff is harder to really understand in the kind of daily news cycle when you're just starting to catch up with what's been happening in Springfield and what the legislators are up to.
So really basic questions that, yeah, I think are really important questions for our civic knowledge, kind of things maybe we learned when we were in elementary school or high school and we've probably forgotten. And so I wanted to start with playing a clip from the first episode of your podcast, because it starts by asking what the attorney general does. Mm-hmm. And then it gets into other elements of our state's very confusing legal system. Here's Ellen Mayer speaking with Hannah Mizell from Law 360 about what the difference is between a state's attorney and a district attorney.
Something that has been also kind of confusing for me, that I'm guessing might also potentially be a little confusing for the audience, is I'm not sure I totally understand what is the difference between attorney general and state's attorney, and then the difference between state's attorney and district attorney. So could you clear that up for us?
Oh, yeah. I think this is like a huge, you know, very common confusion. So district attorney is actually not a term that we use in Illinois. You know, if you are an American human, you have probably watched one or more episodes of Law and Order. And so, you know, in New York, they're always talking about the DA this, the DA that. But in Illinois, we actually have state's attorneys. Same thing, just different name. State's attorneys are elected county by county, and they are in charge of all things criminal law in their county, whereas the attorney general handles mostly civil law.
That's Hannah Meisel speaking with, she's from Lost 360, former Illinois public, I would say former public Illinois public media graduate, speaking with Ellen Mayer. She's the host and producer of the Illinois podcast that answers these questions. I love your little law and order that you got in there, Ellen. But it turns out this is kind of crazy, right? So a state's attorney in Illinois, a state's attorney and the district attorney are the same thing?
Well, yeah, we don't have a district attorney. Instead, we have a state's attorney, but that's just a confusing. If you haven't been plugged in, you know, in a real way in Illinois politics or politics anywhere, and you've just sort of heard these phrases like humming around in the air, which is how most people kind of experience political media, then you might not really know, oh, that's not a thing we have here, and it's different from attorney general at the state level, which is also different from the attorney general at the federal level. That's not really something that they cover in high school in a real way, you know? When would you have genuinely learned that?
Well, even the role of attorney general, what the attorney general is supposed to do, as we've been doing candidate interviews for all the people who are running for attorney general, I started by asking them, what do you think the role of attorney general is? And interestingly, some of them have a better explanation than others of what they think the attorney general should do. And I think that's part of the education piece of this as well, right? There's just a lot of government roles that we don't government offices, we don't necessarily understand what their role is.
Yeah, and I think that's important, especially in an election season, because on the campaign trail, you'll hear people promise to do things that they may not have any power or ability to do once they're in office. You know, a big piece that I learned while researching this story is that Lisa Madigan really ran on this, our current attorney general, Lisa Madigan, ran on this.
Our current
platform.
State's attorney general,
yes,
just to be clear.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's not confusing at all.
Right. She ran on this platform of, I'm going to root out corruption, you know, in Springfield and in, you know, our government. And it turns out there may be some limitations in terms of how much power the attorney general at the state level has to do that. You know, I think there are some like arguments about that, but it's important to understand that so that you can kind of personally fact check what, you know, candidates are saying on the campaign trail.
Well, and I even saw this when I moderated a forum a couple of weeks ago for the Democratic candidates for attorney general, asking them specifically, what would you do? And you hear a lot of candidates speak in generalities, like, I want to fix the opioid crisis. And I'm like, but you're an attorney general. What can you actually do? I want to solve gun violence. But what can you actually do about it? That's the kind of question you're trying to hope to get at with these podcasts.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think one thing about this is that I think journalists, we always like to say we're not afraid to ask the tough questions. But when you introduced the whole idea of this podcast, you said you're not afraid to ask dumb questions. Why is that really important? And I don't know if it's even dumb is the right word to use.
No, that's exactly right. I should actually amend that, because I want my audience to understand that no question that they have is dumb. But I think there is this feeling that, especially if you work in journalism in and around politics, that you ought to be an expert. And I think it obviously makes sense that that's the case, but you have to remember that you are reporting for an audience that probably is not made up of experts. So being able to, you know, humble yourself maybe a little bit and say, and either say, I don't understand this, or I'm going to put myself in the shoes of someone who doesn't understand this and ask questions that might seem basic to insiders. I think that's really important for being kind of empathetic to where your audience is coming from. And again, just being really useful to them in the work that you do.
So can you walk us exactly through how the Illinois podcast is going to work? People submit their questions on your website, then what happens?
Yeah, so it's, if you're familiar in the Chicago area with a show called Curious City, it works in a very similar way. People submit their questions online on my website, illinoispodcast.com, and then I look through the questions that have come in, and I kind of flag ones that I think are really interesting and important, and I will then reach out to the person who asked the question and ask them to tell me a little bit more about why they asked and, you know, what kind of an answer would be useful to them, and then I will kind of, based on the information that I've gotten from my question asker, I will just sort of seek out people who are going to have a good answer and be able to talk about it in a really accessible way, because that's important. And, you know, produce that on the podcast. And a key piece of this also is that if the question asker is willing to, I'd like to include their voice on the podcast itself, get a little bit of the story behind why they asked and why they're interested in state government, because I think that's an important piece for people to hear how their peers are trying to engage with state government in different ways and kind of learn from each other.
So the model that this is based on was developed at WBEZ called Curious City. The national company is now called Harkin. We're using Harkin with the Illinois Newsroom and the 21st to answer questions. We're asking everybody right now on our website to answer a political question, what they think the Democratic or Republican Party should stand for. I should say, if you have a question that you want Ellen to answer, you can call us right now and ask Ellen the question and she'll try to work on it. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21ST Show, as always, and we'll forward them on to Ellen. So you're based in Chicago. Ellen, are there questions and issues about the rest of the state that you're hoping to tackle for our listeners who are listening in outside of the Chicago area, all the way from Rockford down to Springfield?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, most of the questions that I'm going to be tackling are going to be explicitly about a function of our state government that should be relevant to everyone. You know, so for example, the Attorney General of the state of Illinois is someone who impacts everyone across the state. I've gotten questions about what is a witness slip, which is, you know, something that any citizen across the state of Illinois can take advantage of to have their voice heard in Springfield. So I'm always, that's like the basis, is that this is about state government and it affects everyone. But that I'm also always trying to find local issues that will help bring these kind of state functions down to earth. And I, you know, because I live in Chicago, I'm conscious of the ways that maybe the housing and gentrification and debate in Chicago is being impacted by state government. And I'm going to want to talk about that. But I'm also then going to want to look around at what's happening in Peoria, what's happening in Rockford, where are some other cities where these same kinds of dynamics are playing out that are relevant to state government, that can help illustrate for an audience anywhere in the state, here's how our state functions, here's how it functions differently, say, in Chicago than it does elsewhere, and that's really important for not just, you know, getting outside of our bubbles, but also understanding state government as something that happens statewide.
We've actually got a caller who has a question. McClaskey from Springfield. Hi, McClaskey. Welcome to 21st. What's your question
Hello.
You want, Ellen? Hey, there. What's your question you want to ask, Ellen?
I was wondering if she could inquire as to how the Constitution is not being trampled when it basically went to hiring veterans only for certain jobs when the Constitution says life, liberty, pursuit of happiness for all. I've got a 7-year-old daughter. I'm not a military veteran, but I think that she should be entitled to at least the same chance of benefits as the veteran's child in her innocence.
Oh, okay. Thanks for that, McClaskey. So his question, it sounds like, is about veterans and discrimination when it comes to hiring. If you're saying veteran only, I mean, that's a really tough question for you to answer on the fly. But Ellen, can you make a note of that? And McClaskey, if you can stay on the line, we'll get your contact information if you don't mind, and we will pass that on to Ellen. Ellen, it's questions like that. I wonder, it seems like this project is part journalism, but is it also part civics? Is that on purpose?
Yes, that is very much on purpose. Love journalism. I love being in this field, but I just personally became very interested in the civics field as some place where I might want to just grow my career, and also because I wanted to be an engaged citizen myself. But I also think those two things have always been, you know, interwoven. The work that you do on the 21st, informing Illinois citizens about what's happening in local government, what's happening in the elections, is explicitly preparing them, right, to then go and vote. So I think those two things have always been enmeshed, but I have been really hoping to just be clear that the typical conventions of journalism might not always serve civics as well as we think. So I'm just trying to explode some of those conventions and find new ways to talk about local politics that will be most useful and most engaging and most accessible to people to help them engage in government.
Well, thanks very much. That's Ellen Mayer. She's host and producer of the Illinois podcast. I want to thank McCloskey also for calling. We're going to put you in touch with Ellen. We'll tweet out more information for folks who want to get in touch with Ellen and ask her questions for her podcast, which is available now. Ellen, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Just a reminder to our listeners, too, our election coverage is on a new page that we've just debuted today. If you head to 21stShow.com/elections, you can see all of our coverage there. Before we go, last night at the 90th Academy Awards in L.A., Frances McDormand took home the Oscar for Best Actress for her performance in Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. This was her fifth nomination, her second win for this film. She also won a BAFTA, a Golden Globe, a SAG Award, an Independent Spirit Award. Why are we talking about this? Well, Frances McDormand is actually from Illinois. She was born in Gibson City. When the actress accepted her trophy last night, she also gave thanks to her director, Martin McDonough, and her family. And she asked all of the other female nominees from all of the categories to stand with her.
Okay, look around, everybody. Look around, ladies and gentlemen, because we all have stories to tell and projects we need financed. Don't talk to us about it at the parties tonight. Invite us into your office in a couple days, or you can come to ours, whichever suits you best, and we'll tell you all about them.
That does it for us today. That's Gibson City's Frances McDormand. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from Medill at Northwestern University in Evanston. Have a good day.